This is the English Heritage Podcast.
Hello and welcome to your weekly podcast into England's past. I'm Charles Rowe. You can listen to new episodes every Thursday and subscribe to make sure you stay up to date. Today we're looking back at the story of a man who brought free healthcare to the UK in the years after the Second World War. Aneurin Bevan, also known as Nye Bevan, was the founding father of the National Health Service, or NHS, which, 75 years on, remains at the heart of British life. Joining us now to talk about Bevan and the London Blue Plaque commemorating him is senior historian for the Blue Plaque scheme, Howard Spencer. Hello.
Hello, Charles.
One of the first things to say about Aneurin Bevan, of course, is that he's not English. So tell us where he grew up and what his family life was like.
That's right. He's very much a Welshman. He was born in Tredegar in Monmouthshire in South Wales. And he was born into conditions of some poverty. He was part of a family of 10. And of his siblings, only 5 survived to adulthood. And that kind of experience really shaped his political thinking. He had a fairly rudimentary schooling with an unsympathetic schoolmaster, and he was down the pit following what his dad did at the age of 14. So
he was mining.
Yeah, that's right. He was a miner. It was a mining community.
That sounds like a tough start to life. So what drew Nye Bevan into politics, and also what age was he at the time?
Well, as I said, he had a pretty poor schooling. What education he got, he was largely self-educated, which was from reading at the local Tredegar Working Men's Library, and he read a number of sort of classic socialist texts, and that's what developed, I guess, his political consciousness. And he became a sort of campaigner against poverty during the First World War years. 1922, he got himself elected to the local Tredegar Urban District Council. 1928, he was elected to Monmouth County Council. And the following year, 1929, he was elected the MP for Ebbw Vale, which was the constituency that included Tredegar. And this was a very strong Labour area. He was actually unopposed at the 1931 election, which was not a good election for Labour, but that gives you an idea about how strong a Labour presence there was in that area at the time.
So he was the only candidate then?
In 1931, yeah. I mean, he did actually have opposition when he first got elected in 1929. After that election, it was the second Labour government under Ramsay MacDonald, a minority government, but the second Labour government that the country's had.
I see. His political career is developing quite quickly by the sounds of things.
So he was born in 1897. So, yeah, he's 32 when he first gets elected. And his character was a very strong one. He was a very impressive physical, imposing physical figure, a very impressive orator, and this is how he really came to notice, a very good speaker and somebody who could command a room, command a crowd, and so on.
Yes, you can definitely see that actually from some of the pictures that I looked at in preparing for this podcast, and you can really see a man who really took control of a room. How would you describe his political character and the way he operated, not just his oratory and his command of a room, but what went on behind the scenes as well?
Well, he's very much a man of the left. He was actually associated with a body called the Independent Labour Party, which was one of the original sort of bodies that came together to form the Labour Party in 1906. So he's very much sort of on the left of the party right from the outset, and that kind of goes all the way through his career, really. He's very combative. I say he was a great speaker, but he was also not always perhaps very guarded in his language. So, I mean, there was a classic occasion when he referred to the Tory party as vermin. This was actually the speech he gave just as the NHS, which was his greatest foundation, which we'll talk about in a minute, just as this was coming into being. He gave this speech where he said they were, as far as he was concerned, lower than vermin. Of course, this is linked with his upbringing and the poverty that he found himself in. He was obliged to rely on a sister for income because he had no job, and he was just basically bluntly told that he ought to emigrate. And therefore, this is where this kind of resentment sprung from. So it was very much born of personal experience. But it did obviously cause quite a lot of offence. He was a very polarising figure. I guess you could say he was a bit Marmite.
So he basically called the opposition equivalent to rodents, the Conservative Party.
That's right, yes. And because they actually took it as a badge of honour and formed a club called the Vermin Club. So in a way, it was rather counterproductive. I mean, it kind of fed a sense that they were being unfairly attacked. And I put that in the context of his life, and that's how he felt. And in that sense, it becomes sort of more understandable that he had these very, very strong feelings about the party that had been in government and that in his mind had caused his family and himself to live in abject poverty, and many others too. So that's how he felt about it. But as I say, he was such a strong, combative figure, it did sort of have a counterproductive edge to it. And it also meant that some colleagues regarded him as somewhat unreliable. I mean, for example, in 1950, he was passed over by Clement Attlee, the then Labour Prime Minister, for the job of Foreign Secretary, because he just thought he was not a reliable enough character, too impetuous and so on, to do that job.
He sounds like someone who's, as you say, quite combative, quite direct, perhaps even abrasive. But was there any finesse to Nye Bevan? Any sort of shrewdness?
He could be a very charming man. I mean, there are plenty of accounts of the sort of soirees that he held at the house in London, which has got the blue plaque on it, in Westminster Kensington Borders area. He was a great genial host and all the rest of it. So yeah, there was definitely another side to him. He just had this, I guess, you know, kind of an aggressiveness to him that didn't always come across very well. I mean, there are plenty of other politicians you could say that about too. I mean, to actually do that job, I think you need to have a fairly steely persona about you. He certainly had that.
And a thick skin, yes. I suppose he didn't pull his punches effectively.
No, usually not. I mean, I think he mellowed with time. I mean, we'll talk about that a bit later on, perhaps. But yeah, I think he did sort of mellow as time went on, as most people do, I suppose.
Yes. So that's quite interesting. We've got quite a rounded description now, I think, of Nye Bevan, from his early start to the way that he developed his skills within the Westminster establishment. Apart from the NHS, what were his other key political achievements?
Well, so he's Minister for Health in the post-war Labour government, which comes to power after the election in 1945. And this is his first ministerial job. He's sort of coming in from the cold almost, because in the 30s, he'd actually not been flavour of the month with the Labour leadership then. In fact, I mean, he'd actually been expelled from the party for a time for advocating a popular front, which meant basically making common cause with other parties, including the Communist Party at that time, and this was not favoured among the Labour leadership, and he was among those who found himself actually expelled for that reason. So yeah, in 45, he is part of this Labour landslide. He holds his seat in Ebbw Vale without any kind of difficulty, of course. As I've said already, it's a very strong Labour area. And he becomes Minister for Health, and he's best known, as you said, for presiding over the founding of the National Health Service 75 years ago in 1948. But he's also Minister for Housing at the same time. And that's actually rather extraordinary to us now, to think that somebody holding both those portfolios at the same time. And I guess it's partly explained by the fact that at the time he took the job of Minister for Health, that was actually quite a minor role, because you had this incredibly sort of patchwork health service. There was no great need for a sort of a big ministry or whatever to oversee it, because it was all patchwork and very much locally based. Now, of course, he changed all that. But as Minister for Housing, he presided over the building of nearly 1 million homes up to 1950, which is when he moved on, most of which were built for rent and most of which were built by local authorities. So that was his other achievement. And I guess there's the other thing one would point to in his ministerial career, which is actually sort of, you know, reasonably short. It's only just over 5 years that he's actually a minister. But he was part of the enactment of the National Assistance Act, which was basically the final end of the Poor Law in this country. Extraordinary to think that it went on all the way through to the 1940s, but it did. But the National Assistance Act brought in national assistance, which is what later became known as Social Security, Job Seekers Allowance, now be called Universal Credit, I guess. So it brought in that in the place of a sort of a more piecemeal provision that had existed before that was really based on the Elizabethan Poor Law. So that's, again, quite some achievement for somebody who, as I say, wasn't actually a minister for very long.
No, just 5 years, as you say. So sort of at the start of the benefits and welfare state, really.
That's right. Yeah.
And were there any other offices that he held?
He's briefly Minister for Labour after he gives up the portfolio of health and housing in 1950 into early 51. I think it's April 51 that he resigned from that job, and he did so in protest at the Labour government's introduction of charges for certain parts of the NHS. They introduced charges for dental care and charges for eye care. And he violently objected to that. He wanted a service that was across the board, free at the point of use. And therefore he resigned along with a few others, including Harold Wilson. Actually, he also resigned at that time.
Let's now shift our attention to Nye Bevan's main political achievements, the National Health Service, the thing that he's most associated with. For many people listening, it's probably quite hard to imagine a UK without the NHS. What was healthcare like here before it was brought in? You talked about a sort of local arrangement and a patchwork arrangement. So could you give us a bit more detail on that?
Yes, well, I'll use a quote, if I may, which is a quote from Jenny Lee, who's Nye Bevan's wife, and again, more on her later. She said that the health service that her husband found when he became health minister in 1945 was, quote, a great patchwork, a good deal of good intentions, a great deal of inadequacies. So that's it, really. You have a system where you've got some hospitals that come from workhouse hospitals, which have been taken over by local authorities. You've got some where they were sort of long-term foundations and so on, and they work very well, but it depended on which area of the country you were in, how good your service was. And I guess the key thing is that most people were expected to pay for things like GP appointments. I mean, the 1911 national insurance legislation had provided some free GP care, but it tended to be for people that were actually working. So the people who, in a way, really needed it to be free, it tended to be children and the wives of people who were out at work. And at that point, fewer women tended to work. So, you know, they were expected to pay for a GP's appointment. And as a result, you know, many people obviously were reluctant to go to their doctor unless things were really bad. So they were obviously some pretty poor health outcomes as a result of that. So, yeah, it's a kind of an incredible patchwork system. Which you've got some sort of growth of local authority provision in running things like midwifery and things like that. That's sort of growing up in the earlier part of the 20th century. So in that sense, there's sort of some public provision of health does already exist. But, you know, there's nothing sort of overarching in it, as I say. And it depends very much on where you live, on how good a health care you're going to get.
Where did this idea then for a national health service come from? Obviously, you've indicated slightly about why it was necessary, but could you give us a bit more detail on why it was necessary?
Well, the hospital system in this country was pretty shattered after World War II, as you can imagine, because of the demand placed on it. So that's kind of one thing. But I guess the thing in terms of, we're talking about Bevan, I mean, he came to it via his experience in Tredegar, where he chaired a local health insurance club where basically people paid in. And they got free healthcare as a result of that. And that's essentially what we had on a national scale coming in. So that's sort of where he came at it from. And I should also mention the role, of course, of the Beveridge Report in this. Sir William Beveridge, who also has a blue plaque in Camden Hill in Kensington, he wrote this report in 1942, which was basically identifying the causes of poverty and ill health and suggesting ways that might be alleviated in the post-war world. And a national system of health, I mean, it was very, very broad brush, sort of what he sketched. It was one of the things that he came up with. So that's another source of this, a source of inspiration. It's not all about Bevan, although his drive and personality shaped what actually happened.
Ah, so he kind of took inspiration and took an idea and kind of ran with it.
In some senses, yes. And I say Beveridge's report was very important in this.
We've talked about free at the point of use, and that's a phrase that many people in the UK will be familiar with, even from today's politicians referring to the NHS. That's obviously one of the founding principles. Could you tell us about some of the other founding principles of the National Health Service?
Well, that it should be universal, and it should be an even provision as far as possible across the country, I guess. You know, I mean, I think the free at the point of use is the major one that everybody knows about.
So free at the point of use being the main point, it basically means that you're paying into the system via your taxes.
Well, it's via national insurance. Yeah, that's right. Mm. It was basically his fund in Tredegar that he chaired on a national scale. That's how he saw it. So that's how he presented it as well. He referred to this at the time. So you know, you pay your national insurance, and then when you need it, health service is there for you, and you don't pay for it at that point.
How did Bevan's idea get off the ground? Did he have any difficulty? Was there opposition to this idea of a national health service in the post-war years?
Yeah, there was. I mean, there was political opposition for a start. So the Conservative opposition in Parliament voted against his national health bill. Now, I mean, that in parliamentary terms, that can be a sort of Pavlovian response, as in, you know, the opposition just vote against government legislation because that's what they do. And there's been quite a lot of debate about this. I mean, the sort of cited line is that Churchill voted against the NHS 21 times. Now, it's also true, of course, that Churchill was Prime Minister when the Beveridge Report in 1942 was commissioned and written. Now, if Churchill had won the election in 45, we don't know what would have happened, but it's likely that there would have been some sort of National Health Service. And it's also worth noting that, of course, when Churchill did come back to power in 1951, he made some changes, but he didn't dismantle it. So there was a sort of developing political consensus. But at the time, Bevan was putting the Act through, and it was first introduced in November 1946 into Parliament. At the time it was going through, there was certainly a lot of political opposition to it. But probably more crucial was the opposition of the medical establishment, because obviously without them on board, or at least acquiescing in it, it's not going to happen. You know, you can't have an NHS without doctors or other professionals. And they were, I've seen one figure saying that doctors were 10 to 1 against his original plans. And he was called all sorts of things. He was called Tito from Tony Pandy, which is actually wrong about where he's from. So he's from Tredegar. And also to explain who Tito was the communist Yugoslavian leader. And there was a former head of the British Medical Association who actually went even further and compared Bevan's plans to National Socialism and said he would be a sort of health führer. So we talked earlier about, you know, Bevan's rather intemperate use of language. It was thrown at him as well. I mean, there's no doubt about that. That kind of language was being used about his plans. And his response was to change them somewhat. So, for example, GP surgeries were allowed to remain as privately owned entities, and essentially the NHS paid them for their provision. And some senior practitioners were allowed to continue to practice privately as well as working in the NHS. But there were those who still, you know, objected to it. And I think the central objection was the fact that they were becoming, in effect, civil servants. For some people, that really stuck in their throats. I mean, I remember researching a plaque for a woman called Ida Mann, who was an ophthalmologist and an early woman pioneer in that area. And she emigrated to Australia rather than join the NHS because she objected to the idea of being, as she put it, a civil servant. So you can see that for some people, this ran very deep. But with the compromises that he did, Bevan did manage to enact the National Health Service, which came into being on 5th of July 1948. So you say 75 years ago, last July. I think it was not entirely as he would have wished it. I mean, the quote that's often attributed to him is that he said that he stuffed their mouths with gold, which is quite a nice line. And he did say something similar to that, I believe, to somebody about how he'd managed to square it with the doctors and the British Medical Association.
I suppose that was always going to happen, wasn't it, really? Because, I mean, even today, where we have the choice of private healthcare, if people so wish, you can't really stop free enterprise, can you, really, even in healthcare?
Well, it's difficult. As you say, if people really don't want to work for a kind of a central National Health Service, then the example I've given of Ida Mann, they won't do it. They'll go elsewhere. They will leave the country, as she did. And of course, that still happens, I guess.
And I suppose you didn't want your whole system that you're wanting to set up to sort of start crumbling before it could get going. So
no,
you had to
that's right.
Give people that freedom.
That's right. And another point to make is the kind of deference that doctors were treated with at the time, particularly in sort of working class communities, you know, prior to the NHS being formed. I mean, the doctor was kind of somebody who certainly would have been addressed as sir and so on. That was the kind of attitude, which of course changed somewhat in the post-war world. There was rather less of that sort of automatic deference. And in return, it has to be said that, you know, I was reading something about this recently that suggested that doctors did not always treat their working class patients particularly very well. They were often condescending and dismissive. And there's sort of accounts that I've read actually of doctors working in mining communities of the sort that Bevan grew up in, where there would be a line of them and there would be, you know, maybe 60 people waiting to be seen. And they would be, you know, called up to a bench. They'd be asked to sort of describe their complaint, and they'd then be given some pills or other and sent away. And there was very little actual proper examination that went on. So perfunctory, really, that's the best way of describing the treatment that went on before the NHS. So again, that's a bit of context for why it was a popular move to establish something better.
That's quite surprising. Really, I suppose we're both living in the 21st century where we think, you know, everyone is or should be treated the same according to their socioeconomic background when it comes to their health.
No, that very, very much didn't happen. And I think the other thing is that you have to remember that going back 70 or 80 years, people had much lower expectations of their health. I mean, there was a sort of a sense of grin and bear it and get on with it. Much more than there is now, and people had sort of fairly low expectations of comfort as you went down the social scale as well. So, you know, the people that were truly dragged down by their own poverty and their own situation, you know, and you know, we talk about an era when people lived a lot less longer as well.
So the class system was more strongly in place. I think we still very much have it today, but it seems a lot harsher in the mid-20th century compared to now.
Oh, undoubtedly, yes.
You talked about 1948 being a key date, obviously, Howard, the setting up of the NHS. But only 3 years later did Nye Bevan sort of cease his relations with the government. He actually resigned from the cabinet in 1951. What was the cause of this?
Well, he was Minister of Labour at that point. He'd just been shifted in the cabinet, reshuffled. And he resigned that position over the imposition of charges for dental care and for eye care. Now, of course, you know, then and since, funding the NHS has been a problem, and the Chancellor of the Exchequer at the time deemed this was necessary. Bevan and others couldn't accept it, so they resigned. Another person who resigned was Harold Wilson, who later on went on to become Prime Minister, of course.
What other legacies does Nye Bevan leave on the NHS and for the British people?
I suppose the major one is that we do still have an NHS that is, for the most part, still free at the point of use. I mean, you've highlighted the fact that even if you can find an NHS dentist now, you still have to pay for a lot of your care, although you pay a lot less than you would for a private dentist. So that, you know, there is that too. So, I mean, the NHS has changed a lot since. There's been a number of reorganisations, and of course it's expected to do a lot more. I mean, there's an interesting quote from him about this, which is that he said at the time, "The service must always be changing. It must always appear to be inadequate," which is an interesting line because it sounds like he's denouncing it, but he's not. What he's saying is it's always going to look inadequate because there's always going to be more to do, because there's always more that you can do to improve people's health. So he recognised that this was going to be the case, and so it's proved. I mean, I think he would recognise aspects of today's service. He would not approve, I would think, of the increased use of outside providers and so on, but he would approve of the continuing of the principle of free at the point of use.
So looking back at Nye Bevan's political career, is it fair to say that he was quite a controversial figure? We touched a little bit on it at the start, but with the passing of time, do we have, as the public and as you as a historian, Howard, a more rounded, holistic view of Bevan and what he brought to the country?
I think so. And I mean, I think it's interesting to note that despite him being, as I said, a combative and controversial figure in his lifetime, he still founded something that became a great pillar of Britain, you know, something that's accepted almost entirely across the political spectrum now is something that ought to continue. The NHS, I'm talking about this one. So, yeah, I mean, he was controversial in other ways too within his own party. I mean, I've mentioned that he was expelled for a time in the 30s, and that kind of went on with the, as I said, the resignation from the cabinet in 1951. He went on to become a standard bearer of the left. He stood for the party leadership in 55. He didn't get that. Eventually, in the later part of the 50s, there's a bit of a rapprochement between him and Hugh Gaitskell, who's the man who defeated him, who's a more figure in the more right or centre of politics. And he becomes latterly deputy leader of the Labour Party. So there is a sort of a rapprochement going on there. And at the same time, he manages to alienate quite a lot of his own supporters by disavowing unilateral nuclear disarmament. I mean, this is this speech he makes in, I think it's 1957, where he says, you cannot send a Labour foreign secretary naked into the conference chamber, meaning you would not voluntarily give up your own nuclear weapons without having secured something in return. So, and this caused a lot of disillusion among his own supporters. And it was actually, I believe, a source of disagreement with his wife, Jenny Lee. So there must have been some interesting conversations in the household there about that one.
Interesting. So remaining combative even with the most deadly weapons on earth.
Yeah, that's right. Just to take the story on till the end, I mean, he dies prematurely, very prematurely. He's only 62 when he dies in 1960. And he's widely mourned, I mean, right across the political spectrum. I mean, Harold Macmillan, who was then Prime Minister, reads out a heartfelt tribute to him. And Gaitskell is also, you know, a lot of people who've clashed with him in the past are pretty effusive about him. I mean, I guess this does tend to happen when people go before their time, which he very much did.
Yes, people always tend to appreciate things or people after they've been taken away.
Once they've gone, exactly, yes. Yes, it's a feature of human life, I think.
Because none of us are perfect, let's be honest. You've touched on his wife, Jenny, and he is commemorated with a blue plaque at his former London home that he shares with his significant other. And I'm talking about both the house and the plaque. Can you tell us more about Jenny and how she features on the plaque?
Jenny Lee is also commemorated with him on the blue plaque at 23 Clifton Place. She was another member of the 1929 Labour intake, so she became MP for North Lanark. And she also came from a mining background, but a Scottish mining background. And she came to know Nye Bevan because they were Labour MPs together, so they met in London.
And how did they come to be married?
When she met him, she was in a relationship with another Labour politician who was some years her senior, about 20 years older than her. It was called Frank Wise. But she and Bevan became good friends, and Frank Wise died suddenly in 1933. And she and Nye Bevan were actually married the following year. So there was, you know, not much hanging around after that. But it was not initially, probably in her case, a love match, really. It was companionate. But I think she came to love Nye, and it was certainly a genuinely very durable and warm political and personal partnership. And they shared a lot of outlooks. They were both left wingers. Jenny Lee was also a member of this body called the Independent Labour Party, which was a more left wing, an earlier foundation than the Labour Party that was part of it, but retained some independence and was actually sort of disaffiliated in the 1930s after it kind of became very critical of, you know, the Ramsay MacDonald government. And something else to say in this context, actually, is that both Nye Bevan and Jenny Lee were supporters of a Keynesian approach to economic management. Now, I'm not an economist, but I'll try and explain this really succinctly, which is essentially that you borrow money to create jobs and therefore stimulate the economy. Okay, so that was John Maynard Keynes and also a man called J.A. Hobson, who were advocating these were ideas that were around in the late part of the 1920s to combat the Great Depression and the unemployment that resulted. So you borrow money, you create jobs by, for example, a program of public works, say road building or something like that. So both Nye Bevan and Jenny Lee were very supportive of that kind of policy. and the Labour Party hierarchy weren't. They basically just believed in sound money, as it was called, and basically trying to regain the share of global trade that Britain had previously had, and then cutting back on expenditure, which meant cutting things like benefits and so on. So Bevin and Lee were very much against that and in favour of a different approach. Now, they shared this with a man called Oswald Mosley, who, of course, we know from another context. He was originally a Labour MP at that time, and he was the leading advocate at that point of this kind of Keynesian approach to economics. And he got frustrated and formed his own party, which, of course, then went off in another very unfortunate direction, as in it became the British Union of Fascists. So he moved over from left to far right. And Bevin had some associations with Mosley, which later people tried to hang around his neck. But as I say, this was well before Mosley became known as an anti-Semite and a fascist and so on. So it's an interesting connection, and it kind of traces the early days of Nye and Jenny's relationship and their common politics that they shared.
So yes, apart from sharing a roof, were there any other political projects that they worked directly on together? Was Jenny involved in the NHS project?
I think she was inevitably used as a sounding board, as anybody, you know, other half usually is for something as big as that. It's interesting to note that she didn't really have much of a political career herself until Nye Bevin died. She played no part. She was not a minister in the post-war Labour government. She didn't expect to be either, but she was not. So she, at that point, had, I guess you'd say, more of a supporting role. And it's only later that she really sort of comes into her own as a politician. She's mostly known as a in her own right as Minister for the Arts in Harold Wilson's government, the government that was elected in 1964 and held office until 1970. And her major achievement was the creation of the Open University. So, you know, a university that was used radio and television as the means of education mostly, and was open access to everyone. So the idea being to open higher education to a much wider range of people. And of course, this was an enormous success. Ended up with 100,000 students in the 1980s. And in fact, Harold Wilson thought it was the biggest success of his government. And it was she who was in charge of it. And she actually became a very sort of popular figure for her stewardship as Minister of Arts. She was actually the first person to hold that post. It was a newly created job under Wilson's government. So that's her sort of individual claim to fame, as it were.
I suppose as well, she would have been one of a small number of female MPs at the time.
Oh, absolutely, yes. I mean, there weren't very many. I can't give you exact numbers, but yes, no, she was very much as part of a select band at that time.
In terms of the relationship she had with Nye Bevin then, how long was the marriage? Because you mentioned that he died quite early.
Yeah, so married in the mid-30s and he dies in 1960. And I mean, she was absolutely devastated at his death. I mean, she was somewhat prone to depression and so on. And I think she took a long time to get out of it. But I think obviously being appointed to this job in the 64 to 70 Harold Wilson government was something that helped to lift her out of that and helped channel her energies in the right sort of direction. She also wrote a book called My Life with Nye. So she wrote about their life together, which obviously would have had, I imagine, a cathartic effect.
Were they too busy to have a family?
She didn't want children, apparently. She was, in the 1930s when they got married, her focus was on getting back into Parliament, because she had lost her seat in North Lanark in 1931 in what was a terrible election for the opposition. The combined opposition after that election was only just over 60 seats. So, you know, this was the national government, which is where the Labour Prime Minister, Ramsay MacDonald, formed the government with the Conservative opposition, which, of course, has led to a great rupture. So she's out of Parliament throughout the 1930s, and she doesn't come back in until the 1945 election after the war, which is a Labour landslide, and she's elected for Cannock, which is a constituency in the Midlands.
We've mentioned, obviously, that Nye Bevin dies sooner than one would expect. Was he suffering from some sort of disease? Or?
Unfortunately, he had cancer. He was admitted to hospital with what he and the doctors thought was an ulcer, and it turned out to be stomach cancer. And unfortunately, he died within a couple of months of that becoming known. So this is in 1960. As I say, there was a lot of an outpouring of grief, really, at his untimely death.
Was there any particular reason that English Heritage chose to recognise both of them on a blue plaque rather than Nye Bevan on his own?
Yeah, well, to eschew false modesty, it was actually my idea originally to put Jenny Lee on the plaque. I mean, the story of Nye Bevan's plaque is an interesting one because he was actually, I mean, he dies in 1960, as is possibly quite well known. We have a rule with blue plaques, which has been in place for a long time, which is that you can't be considered until 20 years has passed since the date of death, the idea being to allow people's reputation to settle and become thoroughly solid and reliable. So he could have got a blue plaque much, much longer ago than he actually did, because I'm talking about one that happened in 2015, that it went up. And it was approved when the scheme was run by the Greater London Council in the 1980s, in the early part of the 80s, plaque to Nye Bevan was approved, but the owner of the house didn't want it. And again, I mean, this is entering into a certain amount of speculation, but it may be that his controversial reputation and describing his Tory opponents as lower than vermin and so on was still hanging around him and may have contributed to this reaction. So anyway, we play a long game on these things. The case was put back on the shelf, and somebody suggested that we look at it again. Maybe it was, you know, kind of 8-9 years ago. And at that point, it was the point when I realised that Jenny Lee also lived there and was also eligible and also had, you know, an interesting career of her own as a woman involved in politics, when, as you rightly said earlier, there weren't many around, and had this particular interesting achievement of, you know, effectively stewarding the formation of the Open University. And I felt that she ought to be on it. So I'm not judge and jury in this, I should hasten to add. I mean, it goes before a blue plaques panel of experts. So the proposal to commemorate them both together as simply as politicians was put to the blue plaques panel, and they agreed it. So that's how we came to have a joint plaque to Nye Bevan and Jenny Lee at their marital home. And actually, I think it would have been a big mistake to have left her off. I mean, she doesn't have quite the profile that he does, to be perfectly honest, but I still think she's an important figure, and it's quite right that she's on it.
Tell us a bit more about 23 Clifton Place, then, this marital home, whereabouts it is, what the building looks like, the nearest tube stop if people want to go along and have a look at it.
Yes, it's an early 19th century terraced house. It's on the sort of borders between Kensington and Westminster. I think the nearest tube would be Sloane Square, but it's in the sort of slightly amorphous area between, Victoria and Sloane Square. They've been the two stops on the district line. But I think I seem to remember in the 2015 unveiling, I went to Sloane Square to attend the event. And it was their home for 10 years, so quite a good long time.
And thankfully, it's still standing, so that's good.
Interestingly, it nearly wasn't. When they took the lease on it, which was 1944, so before the war had actually ended, but after the aircraft bombing range had ended, you still had the V1s and V2s at that point, of course. But it was actually war damaged, and Nye and Jenny initially moved into the basement while they repaired and did up the rest of the house. But they did eventually occupy the whole house. And in fact, her parents moved down from Scotland to live with them, and her mother was a sort of almost had a personality as a sort of political hostess in being at these various gatherings of the great and good that were held around there.
Were there any other possible locations for a blue plaque to recognise Nye Bevan on his own? Would it have to have been this property?
It was pretty much this one or not at all, which is why, as I said, I mentioned in the 1980s, it was on the blocks and the owner didn't want it, so nothing happened. Because the only other address of any appreciable duration, and it was actually lived in by both of them, was in Guildford Street in Bloomsbury, so that's near Russell Square tube station. And that address has gone. I think there's a supermarket on it now or something. So that was not a possibility, because we would only commemorate original surviving buildings on the basis that once the original building's gone, so is the most meaningful link with the people that lived there. So yeah, this really was the only choice, because after they lived here, and after the 10 years they spent here in the mid-50s, they move out to a farmhouse in Buckinghamshire, and that's where they spend the rest of their time. So there were no other possibilities in London.
When was the unveiling of the blue plaque?
It was in November 2015 that it was unveiled by Neil Kinnock, who, of course, was a one-time leader of the Labour Party and another Welsh Labour MP, like Bevan, who spoke very passionately about Bevan, who he would have known about. And, yeah, it was a very good occasion to get to, particularly, as I say, Bevan had been waiting, I think at that point, you know, something like 30 years or more to get this honour. And thanks be to the owners of the building who allowed it. Thanks be to all the owners of buildings who allow blue plaques, because otherwise they don't happen.
Obviously, we've been talking about Nye Bevan as a UK politician, but we sort of go back to where we started, really, by saying that he is a Welshman, first and foremost, I suppose, and he does have an English heritage blue plaque in London, in the nation's capital. But he remains steadfastly, I think, and I'm sure he'd probably say the same, a Welshman through and through. Where else can we sort of get a sense of Nye Bevan in other parts of the UK, shall we say?
There's a statue, a bronze statue, to him in Cardiff. And he is also commemorated, I believe, at the Welsh Assembly, the Senate in Cardiff Bay. And as you say, yeah, very, very much a Welsh figure who represented the Welsh mining constituency, Ebwy Vale, for all his time in Parliament. Because Parliament necessitated him being in London, which was a city I think he was sort of quite fond of. I mean, apparently he first came to London as a student at the Central Labour College and did a lot of exploring on foot. So I think, like for many people, London sort of drew him in after initially feeling perhaps rather alienated. Anyway, in 2004, he was voted top in the list of Welsh heroes. So he remains very sort of high in the pantheon.
I think that will probably continue for many years to come. Thank you very much, Howard, for taking the time to explain the life of Nye Bevan, founder and father of the NHS. Really interesting personal and political story.
Thanks, Charles.
You've been listening to the English Heritage Podcast. As always, we'd love to hear from you, so why not drop us a rating and a review? Next week, we'll discover how people stayed healthy in Roman Britain.
Pretty much, we can say Roman medicine and the Roman medical staff comes from Greece. Both Galen and the group that are Hippocrates are really key in influencing Roman medicine and Roman thinking about the body.
Thanks for listening. See you next time.